Thank you for the introduction.
It's good to be with you all today, and let's begin with some meditation. We have a topic for the talk after the meditation, which is the roots of discouragement. And so I'd like to incline our mindfulness of the present moment to notice some of the things that affect or conditioned discouragement. So first, please simply take a posture in which you're comfortable and upright. Adjust yourself as needed so that you can sit in a way that feels balanced and alert. And take a moment to feel the body sitting, to actually feel the sensations of where the body touches the floor and what those sensations are. Maybe there's pressure, maybe there's warmth. Feel where your body touches the seat, and again, notice the sensations that appear there. Check the alignment of your spine and make any adjustments so that you're upright and yet relaxed, so that you have the support of an upright posture with a sense of release, and the muscles can relax because you trust your spine to hold you up. You trust the structure of your bones to support you. And so we settle into the body sitting, and we feel the experience of sitting just now. Be willing to feel the experience that you're having right now. No need to try to be a sitting Buddha. No need to compare yourself to a picture you've seen of a yogi sitting in a beautiful posture. Just feel the sensations that are arising right now. Know that you're sitting with equanimity and mindfulness. You might feel the sensations of the breath moving in the body. Feel this breath, this experience, without judging it or comparing it against some ideal spiritual breath that you might have in your mind. Be willing to just open to receive the actual experience of sitting and breathing right now. Sometimes meditators come to meditation with a lot of expectation some idealized images. And to think that a perfect meditation is to adopt some kind of cross-legged posture, some kind of perfect breath. Let go of the expectation. Let go of the ideas of perfection. Let go of the tendencies to compare and judge. And simply be open, relaxed, receptive, patient, and attentive to the actual experience you're having. Sitting and breathing, here and now. When we're mindful of more than just sensation. We are mindful of the mental response to experience. So please notice not only the object that's being known, but also notice the quality of mind that is noticing. What is the experience of your mind now? Is there interest, tranquility, curiosity, equanimity? Do you recognize the experience of being mindful? Or do you feel the restlessness and the craving for stimulus? Do you sense the attachment to entanglements in thought? Do you feel the laziness that dulls the mind? Desire or anger, delusion or fear? So many different mental states can occur. They're rapidly changing. mindful and aware of the experience that you're having right now. Meeting the present experience with an honesty that is courageous, a simple willingness to meet the truth of now. Let go of your assumptions about how your mind should be, how your meditation should progress. And simply become mindful of the experience of the body, of feelings, and of mind right now. Sometimes your attention may be drawn to a thought. Notice thinking is happening. Perhaps your attention might be drawn to a sound. Notice hearing is happening. Perhaps you might notice a mood or a state of mind. Notice that. Perhaps you might notice warmth or tingling. Notice that. Notice the many varied experiences of body, feelings, and mind. There's no need to package them up into a framework that we call my experience and that we claim as something we possess. Rest back with mindful awareness, observing the flow of changing experience. Free from identification, free from comparison, free from possessing the experience as mine. Just observe the actual moment-to-moment experiences of life. What are you aware of? What's happening now in your meditation? As you recognize the experience that is happening, see if you can recognize it as simply that, the experience that is happening, without needing to compare it to what you might expect, without using present experience to confirm a sense of self succeeding or self failing. It's simply what's happening now. Before I ring the bell to mark the end of the sitting meditation, please take a moment to simply reflect on the meditative experience that you've been having for the last nearly 30 minutes. It can be helpful to reflect on the development of our minds, on the causes and the conditions that influence the states that we experience. It can be helpful to consider, was I very mindful during this time? Did mindfulness arise? Or was there some thoughts that just seduced the mind the whole time? What was happening? Can we find a way to reflect on the development of our meditation without using that reflection to boast a sense of success or to create a kind of a negative sense of, oh, I'm failing, discouragement? With wisdom, just reflect. Consider the conditions. Consider the experience. And see what you might learn from that reflection. So I'd like to speak a bit about the roots of discouragement. And this is a topic that has become particularly important in the way that I teach in the last kind of decade or so, maybe a couple of decades, as I have emphasized more and more systematic practices. The systematic nature of both certain approaches to vipassana and to concentration and jhana can, for some people, trigger a tendency to compare, a tendency to want to be at some perceived experience of success and actually not be with the actual experience that's happening. And so I find tremendous value in systematic practices, but to be able to teach them and to be able to use them, I think it's really important that we understand the conditions of comparing and conceit that can arise in the mind and what the roots of potential discouragement are. For some people, discouragement is just an occasional hindrance, but for some people, it's a very chronic obstacle. You might be familiar with the story of Venerable Sona, who at the time of the Buddha was a very diligent meditator. I mean, he was practicing his walking meditation so diligently that the soles of his feet were split and bleeding. He was trying as hard as he could. But even though he was trying really hard, he didn't see that he was making progress. And he was contemplating giving up, going back to the lay life, just living a comfortable life and disrobing. It's sometimes when we're trying our hardest, even perhaps if we're putting in too much effort, excessive energy, forceful striving, that we're the most vulnerable to the possibility of being discouraged. We might think if we're trying as hard as we can and this isn't getting us the results that we seek and our effort isn't good enough, then we have no hope of succeeding. So why even bother to try? But strong effort is not a guarantee of success. Preoccupation with that forceful striving, self-critical demands that we impose upon our efforts, and some idea of perfection, a practice or perfecting a technique, these are not going to free the mind. We need to instead patiently persevere. We don't give up the effort, but we patiently persevere while we trust the unfolding of the path. Our effort in meditation shouldn't be directed towards gaining some idealized and particular state according to a personal timeline. Right effort is not forceful striving, and it's not conforming to an expectation. It's the skillful use of our energy that is applied moment by moment in response to present conditions. Are you applying your effort in meditation to fulfill and conform to some perceived expectation or image of a meditation? Are you clinging to the idea of personal success, personal achievement? Or are you practicing letting go and release? Disappointment, discouragement, and self-doubt can arise through any activity of the comparing mind. And often we experience discouragement when the inferiority conceit is strong. That thought, I'm not good enough. I'm failing. I can't do this. But the process is the same for superiority conceit. The thought, I'm better than. The thought that I just succeeded. I want the approval. I got the approval. I'm getting the praise. I'm getting the pleasant experiences that I desired. We can be disappointed because we didn't get what we want, and that can feed the ego and the conceit of inferiority conceit. But we can also be feeding the ego with overblown praise, being overly impressed with minor achievements. Sometimes I see this with a current rage of tracking progress in meditation through various apps, where people sometimes keep track of how many minutes they sit. And what becomes most important is just their score or the number of hours, rather than really looking at the quality of the mind. Certainly those apps can be used skillfully, but we must be mindful that we're not letting them keep creating an external sense of achievement that becomes a source of conceit, whether superiority or inferiority conceit, that comparing mind that constructs the sense of self. If you can reframe your desire for achievement and approval so that it's not oriented towards gaining any particular experience, and we let go of any fear of not being good enough, then we might be able to see the thought of conceit when it arises and how conceit is fed by craving and by ignorance. We can see the workings then of the comparing mind, whether we're comparing as better than, worse than, or equal to, because comparing underlies the feelings of failure. When we're experiencing discouragement, it can be very helpful to look for the comparing mind, the activity of the mind that is leading to discouragement. Comparing, conceit, and craving are the common roots of discouragement and disappointment. So instead of reacting to our perceived failures or to disappointment with criticism and blame, either blaming ourselves for not being good enough or blaming the teacher for not teaching well enough or blaming the tradition for not articulating the instructions well enough or consoling ourselves with self-encouraging thoughts, which seems more skillful but is still just flipping back and forth, keeping the comparing going and flipping back and forth between inferiority and superiority conceit. We can let go of both of those movements of conceit and look at the underlying forces that are at work. How is it that we buy into the story of self? How do we use conceit and comparing then to construct a view of who I am? If we can bring mindfulness and wisdom to our experience instead of the tired hindrances of craving and conceit, we'll have a lot more potential to overcome this tendency towards discouragement or the flip side of self-boasting and be able to actually know what is happening right here and right now, and undertake a wise development of our practice and be able to use systematic practices without them leading to any discouragement. Sometimes students approach me when they feel discouraged, and I think it's good to approach a teacher when you feel that there isn't, that you're not seeing the progress that you would hope for in your practice. Sometimes there actually are corrections that need to be made or potential shifts in instruction that can really support somebody to deepen their practice and to get out of any ruts that they might feel that they might be stuck in. But most of the time, when people come to me and express discouragement, especially if it's in a retreat context, I can often see that their mindfulness and their concentration are both developing, that there's actually no problem in their practice. They are working with the hindrances skillfully, but nevertheless, they're feeling discouraged because they haven't caught this thought of, I am not getting the experience that I crave for. And craving and conceit can never be satisfied. It always leads to discontent. There can be a hunger for affirmation, a sense of wanting validation from the teacher, perhaps, or wanting to have met a signpost of success in our practice, that sense of, I am succeeding, I get it, I got it. This was worth it. You know, this retreat was worth it. It can, that kind of a desire can torture the mind and can really put an excess pressure on the development of our practice. Conceit and self-judgment can manifest both through blame and through praise. We have to look for both sides of the coin. There can be pride and overconfidence, but that's just the flip side of discouragement into despair. We can be attached to success or identified with failures. They rely upon the same activity of the comparing tendencies of the mind. It really, from the meditative perspective, doesn't matter if it's inferiority conceit, superiority conceit, or equality conceit. Underlying both is the same conceit, I am, the same identification with the story of self that develops through comparison. Both the perception of kind of self-confidence and worthlessness are expressions of the comparing mind and construct the concept of self through comparison. They essentially describe a discontent and suffering mind. A mind that is caught in the story of self and keeps measuring experiences so that we can rate self according to whatever standards we've established in our story. Through mindful investigation, we will see how comparing perpetuates dukkha, dissatisfaction, suffering. And we'll learn to develop some equanimity with success and failure, equanimity with praise and blame, equanimity with gain and loss, equanimity with pleasure and pain. We learned to extract ourselves from the stories of greatness and of defeat and be mindful of the experience that's happening now and bring wisdom to understand the conditions that gave rise to it. That will allow us to adjust our action so that it will develop in the direction of our goals. As the Buddha urged, he said in the Sutta Nipata, one's mindfulness holds one poised in a constant even-mindedness where arrogance is impossible. One makes no comparison with the rest of the world as superior, inferior, or equal. So to deepen our Dharma practice, we have to confront our stories. We have to investigate the underlying forces of conceit. It's not enough to just like try to apply forceful effort and to try to gain some stage on the path of insight or the path of concentration. We need to actually look at the corruptions in the mind, the various defilements, and conceit is a deeply conditioned one. We can bring our resources of mindfulness and wisdom and investigation to meet the painful habits of the comparing mind. And we can develop the capacity to patiently persevere in our efforts without falling into the trap of self-judging behaviors. We need to compassionately meet the tendencies that perpetuate dukkha and see self-judgment as just that, a mental pattern of self-judgment. It's not when we're caught in a reactive pattern and entangled in the story of who we are. It can be very helpful to approach a teacher or a good friend because meeting a teacher or a good friend can have a balancing effect. Good friends, whether they're peers or teachers, offer a kind of stabilizing presence because they're usually not attached to your story. They're usually not caught up in that drama of personal failures or self-grandeur. They just don't buy into the story. They can therefore provide a non-judgmental presence that reminds you of your potential, of your strengths, and your good fortune to have the capacity to be mindful now. Sharing a little moment of joy or equanimity or humor about the mind with a teacher or good friend can really be a much greater support than trying to fish for a compliment or get a kind of a validation or praise. Because that can too easily just fuel the story of self. It can be much more useful just to have a sense of the stability of seeing, wow, look, this mind is attached to a story. Wow, this mind is engaged in comparing, and that leads to dukkha, that leads to suffering. Recognizing our personal narratives, either in the presence of people that we respect who don't buy into our storyline, or in the silence, that safe container of a silent meditative experience where we don't act out the roles and the stories. Whether we're exposing these patterns in relationship to another person or to our own attention in the meditation, either way, it can lead to a deeply transformative insight into the nature of the self story. In the mirror of non-judgmental presence, either that we see through a teacher's eyes or a good friend's eyes, or we bring to our own experience through the power of a mindful observation, the clarity of a calm, clear view of our own minds, we're going to see it's just that, the activity of our minds. It's a mental pattern, a habitual thought. It's not self. Meditators will inevitably face difficult moments as we look into the mind. It can be difficult sometimes to see what is happening, to face the various obstacles and hindrances, to cultivate the mind, to sustain the energy, to keep going as we explore the nature of life and see it in terms that will be liberating, that will free the mind from attachment and craving. There's an interesting discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya where the devas and the asuras were arrayed for battle, and Sakka, who's the leader of the devas, addressed his soldiers and gave him kind of a pep talk, a rally, and he told them, if during the course of the battle fear, trepidation, and terror arise, then they should look up to the crest of his standard. And he said, quote, whatever fear or trepidation or terror you may have will be abandoned. And then he says, if you can't see my standard, then look to that of the various other kings and leaders. Look for their standard for encouragement. But then the Buddha says, well, that's a little imperfect. Those soldiers will still be afraid because their leaders are not devoid of fear themselves. And the Buddha says, quote, if you have gone to the forest or to the foot of a tree or to an empty hut, and fear, trepidation, or terror should arise in you, on that occasion, you should reflect thus. I'm sorry. On that occasion, you should recollect me thus. The Blessed One is an Arhant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the Enlightened One, the Blessed One. For when you recollect me, whatever fear or trepidation or terror you may have will be abandoned. And if you cannot recollect me, then you should recollect the Dhamma and the Sangha. For what reason? Because the Arhant, the perfectly enlightened one, is devoid of lust, devoid of hatred, devoid of delusion. He is brave, courageous, bold, and ready to stand his place. I think this is an interesting one because sometimes we do feel fear on the path. We are uncertain if we can face the situation that seems to be enveloping us. But we can remember the possibility of enlightenment. We can remember the awakening of the Buddha. We can have confidence and trust that another human being has ended the defilements in his mind, and that can tell us that it's possible for us. We can contemplate the path of the Dhamma and know that there's a way, and we can recognize that there is a community of people, of beings, who are practicing this way. The goal of the path is the ending of greed, hate, and delusion. It's a profound path, an amazing goal, an astounding possibility. This is the very definition of full awakening. It's perhaps so great that I don't think we should think that it should be easy. I don't see why one would be disappointed if one didn't end all lust, hate, and delusion in their minds on their first 10-day retreat, or on their second, or on their third, or perhaps even in this lifetime of diligent practice. It's a profound, astounding goal. What a possibility to end all greed, hate, and delusion. So when I contemplate this amazing goal, I feel inspired. I don't feel like there has to be rapid and measurable progress or quick results to make it worthwhile. For me, remembering goal is an important part of the practice because it reminds me of a commitment and it adds a powerful supportive structure to continue to persist in the practice, even when it's not feeling good. How do you remind yourself of the aim of practice, of the potential of the developed mind? Do you remember and recollect the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha? Some people formally take refuge, perhaps even use a chant or something to remember and to start their meditation with thoughts of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Some people like to engage in sutta study. Reading inspirational texts are a really traditional way of, or a common way of remembering why we're doing this. We get inspired by reading or by hearing the teachings. Coming to events like this, where each week you get a little dose of some new Dhamma and keep it lively, keep it engaging. It's not always easy to keep our commitments and our practice vows in the complex activity of daily life. So adding supports to keep us going in times of difficulty are very important. By doing so, we help maintain the commitment. And when we maintain the commitment, we know that we haven't let ourselves down on the little things. I think it's important to maintain our commitments not only with our meditation practice, but also with the ordinary things we do in social and work and normal activities. If we say we're going to do something, do it. If we make a commitment, follow through on it. If something happens that you have to change the commitment, you can change it, but don't blow it off. If you say you're going to be somewhere, be there. Those little things add up, and they might be adding up to weaken your mind, to make your words to yourself weaker, or they might be adding up to add strength and potential to your own capacity to have an intention and to follow through. For example, sometimes when people are discouraged on a retreat, the feeling is to quit and they want to pack and go home. Now, of course, there are some times when it's better that somebody not be in retreat and it's wise to leave before the formal end of the retreat. But usually discouragement is not one of the reasons to leave a retreat. In fact, I've seen people who slipped out feeling discouraged harbor feelings of failure for a very, very long time. Whereas those who also were struggling with discouragement completed the process, stayed through the end of the retreat, found support and perspective through the closing process and the interaction with other Sangha members, and actually did not end up walking out feeling discouraged at all. They were able to then just see that movement of mind that was telling a story. If we take action on the story of discouragement and quit or leave the retreat, we have really empowered the fiction of that story of self, that inferiority conceit. So we have to notice those thoughts. The thoughts that says, I can't do this. The thought that says, I'm not good enough. The thought that says, everybody's better than me. The thought that says, if I don't get to the first jhana on this retreat, then I'll never do jhana practice again. Or the thought that says, if I don't get to stream entry, then I'm going to go try a different practice. So we have to let go and we see those as as thoughts. Not allow the self-judgment that's embedded in them, the shame that arises in response to them, the emotional insecurity that is underneath them, or the embarrassment to stop sabotage our practice and keep us from inclining towards that amazing goal of ending greed, hate, and delusion in our own minds. We have to examine the comparing mind when it arises, and see it when it arises in the context of practice. See the story as a story and not believe it. Now, sometimes getting some positive feedback, some gentle encouragements from supportive friends and teachers can help us get back on track. But ultimately, we can't look for the encouragement from outside sources all the time. Ultimately, it's our direct insight into the painful pattern of conceit that will free our minds. We must recognize conceit arising in the guise of disappointment whenever we feel, it's not working, I'm failing. And equally in the pride of accomplishments when we think, I got it, I am at this stage. Although it's natural to want and skillful to seek support, to seek support when we're struggling, sometimes it's just better to not get the encouragement from outside sources. And once in a while, you'll meet a teacher who won't give you what you want. And that could be a very good thing. Because sometimes it's better to be forced to face the painful state that our own minds create and to see that it is a story that we have woven. We can learn how if we have established an expectation, it's very likely to lead to disappointment. The Buddha said, what people expect to happen is always different from what actually happens. From this comes great disappointment. This is the way the world works. That's from the Sutta Nipata. So I'd like to encourage you to just do your practice. Be mindful. Cultivate the mind without expecting anything from it. Without expecting it to be easy, without expecting to get to certain stages, without trying to map and identify where you are all the time, without expecting progress at a predictable rate. In one discourse, a young deva complained to the Buddha that the practice was difficult. He said, hard to do, blessed one. Very hard to do, blessed one. And the Buddha offered a gradual teaching on virtue, contentment, tranquility, concentration, and walking the path. And with everything the Buddha taught, the Buddha again remarked, oh, it is hard to do. And to each complaint, the Buddha acknowledges that, quote, they do even what is hard to do. They gain even what is hard to gain. They concentrate even what is hard to concentrate. Though the path is impassable and uneven, the noble ones walk it. This was from the Samyutta Nikaya. The Buddhist teachings offer us such a worthy goal. Remember that complete ending of greed, hate, and delusion. It's not a path that promises immediate gratification, but we can take every opportunity to let go of the habits that perpetuate suffering, to deconstruct the stories of self that are just fiction, to find ways to remind ourselves of the potential of liberation. There are so many ways that we can encourage our own minds to keep going and to prevent discouragement or uplift the mind if we have become discouraged. For myself, I find the most potent method to keep the mind inspired and to overcome any potential discouragement is to read the discourses of the Buddha. For me, they're an unparalleled source of inspiration. The ancient suttas illuminate the highest purpose, the goal of the path. They offer specific tips that we can apply in our practice. They help keep the goal in mind and remind us that we are part of a long and effective practice tradition. By contemplating the discourses of the Buddha, there's a powerful combination that I feel, where it combines both an urgent desire for liberation and a sense of confidence and inspiration or trust in the potential of this practice. It creates a sense of deep patience that my job is to keep doing the practice, to abandon the unwholesome and to cultivate the wholesome, to use my life, not only my sitting practice, but every moment of the day, to abandon the unwholesome and cultivate the wholesome, to keep aiming for this possibility, this potential, this possibility to free the mind completely of greed, hate, and delusion. It's not necessary that I impose any kind of pace for the development. It's not necessary that I impose a timeline for success. And it's not necessary that I see measurable progress on a regular basis. I encourage you and all serious practitioners to read the discourses of the Buddha, to join sutta study discussion groups, and perhaps even once in a while to memorize a few inspiring verses so that you have them at ready access for later reflection. It can be very powerful to incorporate the direct teachings of the Buddha into your contemporary meditation and mindfulness practices. So I think I'd like to shift into a question and answer session. I also have a few things I might want to suggest more specifically, but I'll see how the questions go and see what comes through that. Before we go to the questions and answers, I just want to express my appreciation for your practice and your attention. Also my appreciation for your support of both Sangha Live and myself as a Dharma teacher through your generous donations in the form of dana. The Give Dana Donate button is at the bottom of your video screen, and those contributions are much appreciated. Though sometimes in online events, people want to hide a little bit in the group, I hope that you will take the opportunity to practice generosity and to take joy in the opportunity that you have to give. I also want to mention that I teach a number of events, both in person and online, and you can find my events at bodhicourses.org and at IMSB for Insight Meditation South Bay, IMSB.org. Bodhi Courses currently has an online course open for registration for just this week. Registration closes on Friday. I hope you'll consider joining us. It is a sutta study, an 8-week sutta study organized around the beautiful similes and stories that we find in the discourses. It's called Timeless Wisdom. And I also have an online weekend retreat that is open for registration, and that is also only open for registration this week. The weekend is happening this next week, the 17th through the 19th, and it's on the theme of deepening concentration, Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday. So if the time zones work for you, I would love to see you. So I am going to look and see if you have posted any questions for me. Okay, there's quite a few questions, but let me, one of them is a long one, let me read it. Okay, so the first question says that with the pandemic, eviction, and some deaths, I have let my practice go completely in favor of hiding under the duvet and watching comfort TV. I am trying to start again, but I feel ashamed and a fraud that I abandoned the Dharma and let down the Sangha when times got tough for everyone. How can I start over with a good heart and a beginner's mind? It's a beautiful question. I think coming to this session is an excellent approach. So I put this on your calendar for every week and I'd find a second group. I think if you're struggling to establish a practice, one or two groups during the week can really help, because if you slip, then you have a group to come to and the meditation's guided. I think there's a lot of resources we can use to help structure a practice through online things, but I wouldn't do it every day with groups. I think we have to actually do it internally ourselves. So that's why I suggest once or twice a week is great. Three times maybe, if one of them is a kind of a class where you're learning a topic. So you use something from community to support the practice. That is wonderful. But you also then challenge yourself to sit a bit in between those sessions. So first of all, if you're going to do it, you have to put it on your calendar in advance. You have to register for the things. Sometimes it's really helpful to lay down money in advance, because sometimes people are more committed to things that they have, committed some funds to. So Dharma classes can be very helpful to help establish a practice like that. You can also be sure to try to set a time for your practice and a way that doesn't feel overwhelming to you. That feels like it would be fairly easy to do. And then set up a reminder so that you remember to do it. So you might not start with a two-hour practice commitment every day. You might just start with a 10 or 15-minute practice commitment and see how that goes. You might do it in a place in your home that feels safe and comfortable. Not underneath the duvet. That's a little bit too relaxed. But maybe looking out a window, or at a time of the day when you feel not too pressured. Keep your commitment doable. So say 15 minutes maybe is just a offhanded suggestion, not knowing the conditions that you're living in. And your other responsibilities, but say 15 minutes. And then, if you're sitting there for 15 minutes, just because the 15 minutes are up doesn't mean you have to stop. You can always enjoy some extra time meditating, but you keep the minimum commitment. So you choose the minimum commitment that you really feel is doable. And if a day comes and you've just, skipped it totally, completely forgotten or got involved in something else, notice what, just reflect. Notice what was it? Was it craving for something else? Was it aversion to the sitting? Was it fear of the mind state? Was it simply laziness? What was it? Was there distraction? Was there a sense of self-doubt that I can't do it? Try to identify the hindrance. Try to identify the obstacle. It's not that you are that kind of person. It's not saying I am a lazy person or I am so filled with doubt, I'm worthless. We're not believing the story, but we need to see what is that obstacle that is keeping us from doing something that we actually care about, something that we actually feel would be of benefit to ourselves and the world. Because I am totally convinced that reducing greed, hate, and delusion in this world is a really good thing for everyone. So touch into the part of you that trusts that. Not that we have to completely end it for it to be worthwhile, but any moment that we are bringing less hate, less fear, less greed into the world, I don't know, I can really get around. I can get my head around that. I can get my heart around that. It makes me want to practice. So if that aspiration is inspiring for you, great. If not, maybe there's something else. Maybe there's another aspiration. Maybe a wanting to cultivate a more open heart or meeting life more fully. You might articulate an aspiration in a different way, but it's worth trying to articulate that aspiration and start each meditation reflecting on the potential and the aspiration. I don't know if you want to reply in any way or if I'll be able to find your reply, but if you do, go ahead and we can have a little bit of a dialogue. Otherwise, I'll just go on to the next question. The next question is about conceit, and it asks, would I explain a little more about how the word conceit is used in this context? This person says she's familiar with pride conceit, but would like to hear more about inferiority conceit and the relationship between conceit and the idea of self. Well, in the Buddhist practice, conceit is linked to the comparing mind. It's about the construction of self through the comparison. So it's the conceit I am that arises often through the comparing of I am better than, I am worse than, or I am equal to. They're all equally different kinds of conceit. So working with conceit is an opportunity to work with the comparing mind. And it's a very interesting a process, because then we might see many, many other things about the comparing mind, about how we judge ourselves or others, how we construct a sense of self through favoring or opposing the various things that we see, how conceit arises in relationship to feeling, the liking and the not liking have conceit embedded in them. There's just a whole lot. Once you get interested in it, you can start to see this arising of the conceit I am. So I would encourage you, if this interests you, and when you hear a talk and there's something that you think, oh, I'd like to hear more about that. What's more interesting than hearing me talk more about it is that if I said just enough to spark curiosity in you, then you can contemplate it. That's where the practice gets interesting, is contemplating it, of trying to notice, say for the next week, just start to notice any time in the day where there is an evaluation. And actually write it down on a piece of paper or something. So you evaluate. Oh, there's an evaluation of this is better than, worse than, or equal to. Don't forget the equal to. If you want to do it, you might want to just do better than and worse than. Those are easier to notice, and then later do equal to. But equal to is people get really trapped in this equality conceit, and start to first recognize when the mind is, thoughts are related to this comparing. And you might notice if there's more one way or another. You might notice then the degree to which the self story rests in one or another. You might notice your actions that you take based upon this comparing. And notice that the comparing, they're happening in our minds. They're not real. It's the comparisons are not real. It's not a reality in the world. It's an evaluation in the mind. So it's really a very interesting and deep subject to explore. I hope you enjoy it. So this question of equality conceit and why that's not skillful is also sometimes a confusing thing, because in some contemporary Western cultures, we think equality is always good, you know, but how is it functioning? In this context, what I'm speaking about, the comparing is functioning to construct an identification with self, a self that we then cling to and identify with. It's totally delusion. So even though it might seem equal, which to in a democratic culture might be favorable, it's from a liberating perspective, it's a total trap. It's constructing a sense of the its attachment to the construction of self through equality conceit. So we have to look at the attachment, the craving, the clinging that arises along with that comparison, along with that that conceit, and see the delusion at its root. Another question. I think the concept of enlightenment can get in the way of practice. It creates a need for perfection when we compare ourselves to an idealized vision of how we should be. Please comment on how enlightenment can be useful or a stumbling block for practice. This is a difficult one for me to respond to because I find the possibility of awakening to be entirely inspiring. There is nothing about the ending of greed, hate, and delusion in this world that I find discouraging. I sense that this possibility is amazing and that we know those states for ourselves in small moments. And as we develop in our spiritual practice, we also know the reduction of greed, hate, and delusion. And I'm convinced that it's a good thing that it is, so in many ways, I feel that just hearing about the possibility or contemplating the possibility of the actual ending of greed, hate, and delusion, of the eradication of the fetters of conceit and craving that keep us bound to delusions. To me, I just find that very inspiring. It doesn't matter to me whether my current moment, this current moment right now, has succeeded in that. You know, my practice is to be mindful and to work with the conditions right now, to meet those, to not pretend that I'm somewhere else. But the practice of now is inclined towards this possibility of greed, hate, and delusion ending. You know, this clarity of mind. It creates a need for perfection when we compare ourselves to an idealized view of how we should be. All of that's just conceit. That has nothing to do with the concept of awakening. It has nothing to do with the potential to end the defilements. So I can't really respond to it creates a need for perfection because when we compare ourselves to an idealized vision of how we should be, because I don't believe we need to compare ourselves to an idealized vision. I think we have a sense of the purpose and the potential for developing this mind. I don't know if that helps or confuses the matter, but you can add another comment if you wish. Another question. So many retreats are online now, and without the in-person Sangha support, I find it too easy to blow off or quit the retreat. Staying with it is hard. Given the surge of Delta and variants, my local Sangha isn't offering any in-person retreats for a while. What are some techniques to get through this stage that seems to inevitably happen in a retreat for me? The commitment is really important. And I think we have to make that commitment to an at-home retreat just as much as to an in-person retreat. It might be that you really do clear your calendar completely and turn off, you know, don't check email, don't check the phone, don't turn on the TV. Be very strict about those things when you do an at-home retreat. It could be that you need that you'd benefit by going someplace else for your online retreat, like renting a cabin in the woods where there's internet but not much to do, or house sitting for a friend who's out of town, or find some way of structuring it so that you kind of take it more seriously. I do think it's important when we make commitments to keep it and to practice keeping it. We don't need to beat ourselves up when we didn't, but we can reaffirm our commitment to do it better in the future. I also think sometimes people sign up for things that they don't really intend to do. So check your intention so that you're interested in it and you make it a priority. I guess that gives you something to work with. Mostly, you really to change the pattern, you have to see for yourself what the lure is to distraction. You know, you signed up for the retreat, you want to do it, I assume. You're here, you value your meditation. So when you're blowing it off, what are you blowing it off for? What's the lure? And is that temptation really going to bring you greater happiness and greater peace than cultivating the mind? Another comment. Sometimes, not often, but at times, a strong emotion overtakes me and I can't sit and meditate. This happened to me yesterday when all the remembrances of 9/11 affected me. Although luckily I'm not a survivor. Anyway, I'm not sure if the person is a survivor or has a relative in the thousands who died or does not. But in any case, I think the world changed that day, at least the world of the United States certainly did. And many people died, and it's something that we feel deeply. And it's okay to feel that. Sometimes we can feel it in the form of our meditation, but if an emotion is too strong to feel in the sitting posture, then you might need to be walking, do walking meditation. You might need to talk with somebody about it, have a conversation with friends. It might require just a little bit of time, you know, like maybe it's too much all in one today. But we do, you know, life is hard. And that event was a terrible tragedy. And I would be more concerned if you didn't have strong feelings than that you do. But I think our practice can be strong enough to meet even the most painful and intense emotions. And our practice can include the rocky moments, not just the calm moments. We can be mindful of fear. We can be mindful of pain. We can be mindful of sadness. And we can include that in our practice so that we meet it with wisdom and with wise attention. So I don't think of practice just as being able to sit quietly, not thinking and being calm. Sometimes there will be thoughts. Sometimes there will be strong emotions. Can we allow our practice to be spacious enough and our attention balanced enough to meet those experiences? And if it's too much, like I said, for the sitting posture, try walking meditation. There's a question of how do you suggest to start studying the suttas, where to begin? I would recommend a couple of places. The first is that there's a book by Bhikkhu Bodhi called In the Words of the Buddha, which is an anthology of different excerpts from the suttas. And it goes across a number of different collections. For example, in my talk today, I referred to a couple of collections, the Samyutta Nikaya and the Sutta Nipata. But there are is also the middling discourses, the long discourses, the numerical discourses, etc. And I think that's a nice, simple beginning for somebody who hasn't done any sutta study before. I also think it's really helpful to join a course. If you're available, I would say join my course. It's happening it's starting next week. So that will allow you to then have a discrete set of readings and a group together to talk about it. And I'll introduce it and I'll work with you, work with the group in terms of discussing the sutta. Discussing the suttas bring them alive. Different people have different ideas about what things mean. And it can be really, really, really helpful. So I recommend sutta study. And when you're ready to just pick up a book, a collection of suttas, and just go cover to cover, then the book I recommend reading first is the Middling Discourses, because it's a collection of about 150 discourses, which is not too many. It's not a huge book, but it's also not too short. It'll keep you engaged. And they're written in a narrative form. So it's a narrative is generally easier to read than some of the other styles of the suttas. It also has a wide range of practical topics, meditative experiences, profound teachings on awakening, etc. So you, in the Middling Discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya, you get a good overview, and it's quite easy to read. I'm personally partial to Bhikkhu Bodhi and I think it's Nyanamoli's translation. Nyanaponika. It's from Wisdom Publications, so you should be able to find it easily enough. Would somebody correct me on who translated that? My mind is not coming up with the right name, and I know one of you know it. So I think we're getting to the ending of our time together. I know there's a couple more questions, but I think we are we're at the end of our time. So I want to thank you very much for your participation. Great to talk with you, I hope that this has been helpful to look at the roots of discouragement, so that we don't buy into the story of discouragement, but we look at the underlying patterns of the judging mind, of the self-constructing, of the trying to be at a place where we're not, the trying to create a sense of self and get confirmation of that through our practice. And just trust more and more the meeting of the experience that's happening right now in a trajectory of awakening, in directed toward the possibility of ending greed, hate, and delusion. So thank you.